Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and assistant professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, we'll be talking to Maria Tarutina about her new book, The Icon and the Square, Russian Modernism and the Russo-Byzantine Revival, which was published by Penn State University Press and, I'm happy to announce, recently received the 2019 USC Book Prize in Literary and Cultural Studies. Dr. Tarutina is assistant professor of art history at Yale NUS College in Singapore, where she's been teaching art history since 2013. Her research explores the architecture, painting, and sculpture of Imperial and early Soviet Russia with the aim of tracing its historical contribution to international modernism. Dr. Tarutina has published two other books. The first was a co-edited volume titled Byzantium Modernism, and that came out from Brill in 2015. And the other was the recent edited volume New Narratives of Russian and East European Art Between Traditions and Revolutions, which was just published by Routledge at the end of 2019. The book she wrote, which we'll be discussing today, though, charts the rediscovery and rigorous reassessment of the medieval Russo-Byzantine artistic tradition between the years 1860 and 1920. In particular, Dr. Tarutina argues that there was an intimate link between Byzantine revivalism and modernist experimentation, one that ultimately contributed to the formation of the 20th century avant-garde movements that are so well known. The book, in this sense, retrieves a neglected but really vital history, one that has been ignored in favor of the secular formalism of mainstream modernist criticism. As a result, her investigation builds a compelling counter-narrative to prevailing notions of Russian modernism, one that attends to the dialogue between generations of artists, but also collectors, critics, and theorists. The book, in my opinion, is a real contribution, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Maria Tarutina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if you could begin the interview today by telling us a little bit about yourself, who you studied with, where you got your PhD. Just tell us who you are and what we should know about you.
So I studied at Yale University in New Haven, where I got both my Bachelor of Arts, but also my my doctorate. So I was there for a total of 12 years, actually.
I never knew that. Oh my gosh. Wow. That's extraordinary.
A lot of time in New Haven, which I actually really enjoyed. And I actually worked with two dissertation advisors, David Joslett, who is a modernist, and he's well known for his work on post-war and contemporary American art. And then with Tim Barringer, who is a scholar of Victorian art. So I didn't actually work with a Russianist, which was really, I think, in the end, a positive thing because it gave me a chance to think about different disparate fields in a way that I think I wouldn't have done had I focused exclusively on Russian art. And that's actually how I came to this project, because I was looking at comparable phenomena in different contexts and sort of wondering, well, how does this play out in the Russian context? So I think that was one of the reasons why I came up with this topic.
Mm-hmm. Where are you from originally? You have a Russian background, I'm assuming, from your name, and we've sort of discussed this before, but tell our listeners, you know, that angle of things as well.
Right. So I'm originally Russian. I was born in Moscow, but ended up leaving Russia at the age of four because my father was a journalist. He was an international correspondent for Pravda at the time. And so we actually moved around quite a lot when I was growing up and predominantly lived in sub-Saharan Africa. So I grew up in Ethiopia and Zimbabwe. And then after that, went to the U.S. for college. And now I'm in Singapore, where I've been living for the last 6 years now. And here I'm working at Yale NUS, which is a new liberal arts college that's been newly created by Yale University and the National University of Singapore. Just opened in 2013. So that's my, I guess, third continent, if you can call it.
Yeah, that. Wow, what a history of travel. You know, I wonder, or I imagine that informs your work as well, in terms of you just really coming from this truly kind of global perspective, this thing we're looking for in art history nowadays, honestly.
Well, I can certainly tell you that for my second book project, that's something that has really, being located in Asia, has definitely changed the way I think about European and Western art. But That's for another day.
Yeah, I am going to sneakily sort of circle back around to that at the very end, because I do want to hear about your next project, but only once we've really gotten to dig into this one. So I know that you mentioned just a moment ago, in terms of telling us about your background and this fascinating, you know, combination of dissertation advisors that you had, and how that, you know, brought a certain perspective that made you start thinking about modernism, I guess, in the expansive way that this book covers. But can you say a little bit more about how you came to write The Icon and the Square?
Absolutely. So the book comes out of my dissertation. So I originally sort of conceptualized it while I was still at graduate school, and it actually came out of the graduate coursework that I was doing. I was taking a couple of classes at the same time, and there seemed to be some gaps, or let's say inconsistencies for me, that I really wanted to grapple with. So the first one was a seminar on the Gothic Revival in England and Germany, and it was very much discussed as this pan-European phenomenon, right, in the mid-19th century. And I was very curious how that would look like in the Russian context, because, well, there is no sort of Gothic or Renaissance legacy in Russia, and yet there was this, you know, pan-European 19th century phenomenon of sort of looking back to this deep medieval past. So I was sort of curious about how that would, you know, how that is reflected in the Russian context. So that was one aspect of it, kind of the larger question of medieval revivalism. The other one was a seminar that I was taking on Byzantine icons with Rob Nelson. And there seemed to be this big disjunction. And of course, I'm trained as a modernist. And there seemed to be this big disjunction between how modernist artists in the early 20th century were perceived to understand icons as objects, right? And the argument there goes that they're flat, right? They have these proto-modernist qualities about them. And to quote an art since 1900, right, our sort of Bible of modern art as the textbook, there is a section on Totlin, which says that Totlin used icons in the way that Picasso used African masks, right? So that's to say, sort of mining them for purely formal elements. However, when you look at sort of scholarship on icons, in fact, they're discussed as anything but flat, right? There's this big emphasis on the kind of haptic and experiential qualities of icons rather than the purely visual. And so to me, that seemed like a real disjunction. Why are sort of 20th century artists seeing icons as sort of flat images, when in the Byzantine context or in the medieval context, they're seen as these mobile, right, multi-sensory and fully spatialized experiences? And then I sort of started thinking, well, maybe that's just us misunderstanding, right, the early 20th century. Maybe there was more going on. So that's sort of how I came at it, from both the revivalist sort of 19th century angle and then the sort of early 20th century, question of, well, how do artists use these quote unquote primitive objects, right? Do they actually even see them as primitive, or is that a misnomer? And I guess the element in that is, how is it and why is it that some of the earliest examples of abstract art come out of Russia, right? Which certainly in the early 20th century is in many ways seen as this peripheral backwater, right? And when compared to Europe, or in compared especially to Paris. And yet, you know, some of the biggest names associated with abstraction are Russian rather than French artists. So I was also kind of curious to know, what was it about Russian culture and Russian history in the early 20th century that enabled artists, you know, to engage these sort of big paradigmatic shifts in the visual arts, when one would more sort of naturally expect that to happen in Paris, right? Sort of capital of the 19th and early 20th century. So those were kind of all the questions that I was curious about and thinking about sort of addressing and trying to figure out. And that's essentially how this book came into being, me trying to sort of grapple with some of those questions and
those
I guess
big
gaps.
Questions. I just love hearing the sort of backstory about how books come about. You know, sometimes it's like you're describing, it's in very specific lectures or seminars, or, you know, I think sometimes it's after reading other people's books and you sort of realize that there's a spot that they left open that you want to jump into. I mean, everybody has a different story. And I in a way, I wish we added to our acknowledgments in our books, you know, a sort of brief paragraph about how these things came about. But, you know, then what would we have to discuss in interviews? So thank you for sharing it with us. So I want to dive into the book itself. You know, we've kind of got a nice foregrounding going already. Our listeners have a sense of the kind of issues you're grappling with in the book, but it actually has a really fascinating structure. And I wonder if, before we kind of dive into the material in each chapter, and see, you know, what direction that takes us. I wondered if you'd kind of talk about this, the first two chapters being kind of long form introductory material, as maybe the way I would describe it, kind of setting the stage, but in a way that I just found so helpful. I mean, I could imagine assigning that first chapter in particular to even undergraduates, I think, and really having them get a different perspective on Russia, on the avant-garde, on this Byzantine heritage, you know. But then the last three chapters are what I would call case studies, but I know you say something in the introduction about kind of these are not your standard case studies, and you're right that they're not, but focusing basically on specific artists and the context of their time and the influence that they had later. So how did you come to formulate this kind of structure of the book in terms of these two different modes that you're in?
So that's a really good question. I think the way I was thinking about it is that the sort of the discursive landscape in the early 20th century and how icons were understood was itself constantly shifting. It wasn't stable, and sort of that's what I try to emphasize in the book, that there are both the artists themselves, but also a lot of the critics, right, and art theorists of the early 20th century have oftentimes competing views. And I felt that in order to understand, you know, how and why these competing views came into being, it was really important to sort of see what happened in the decades preceding them. And I think that one of the things that we see a lot with the sort of history of Russian modern art is that it's often treated in a vacuum. We sort of have this narrative of, well, it all starts in Paris in the 1860s and 70s with the Impressionists. Then we move forward to the Neo-Impressionist Cezanne. Then, of course, we have Picasso and Matisse. And then insert your Russian avant-garde artists here, right? And, of course, there's the famous story of how Tatlin went to Picasso's studio in 1914, and that's how he got his idea for the corner counter reliefs, right? So there's a sense that it's a narrative that shifts directly from Paris to Moscow in the early 19-teens. And to me, this felt a little, you know, this is how we teach art history. That's a lot of how, you know, art history textbooks are written. But it just seemed that it didn't do justice to the reality of the time and of the moment. And that in fact, of course, Russian artists in the early 20th century were in dialogue with, you know, trends in Paris and Munich, London, and elsewhere. But I also think, you know, they're also fundamentally embedded in their own cultural context. And so to me, it felt really important to look at, you know, some of the debates that were going on in Russia in the 1890s, and how that also shaped those artists, because that's when they were coming of age, that's when they were studying in art schools, right? What were some of the key issues, right, that were happening at the time? And I think this is a general trend that we see in scholarship on modern Russian art, that the modernist period is sort of treated in isolation of what happens in the 19th century. And I think, you know, that's not to say, you know, I'm not, and I want to be very clear about this, I'm not trying to advance some kind of nationalist, you know, narrative. But I do feel that it's important to think of an embedded art history, right? In a way, artists are absolutely in dialogue with major international trends, but are also still guided by local concerns at the same time, right? So there's this kind of, in my mind, push and pull between the sort of the local, the regional, and then the global and international. And I feel like oftentimes the local and the regional gets left out in favor of the global international. So that's a kind of history and context that I wanted to excavate, especially because as I came to see doing my research, that you see a lot of alliances in the art world that you would think are completely counterintuitive, right? And by that, I mean, you know, you have Byzantine scholars, right, who are interested in sort of, you know, archaeological concerns, excavating and restoring these medieval churches. How on earth, you know, and why would their interests align with these avant-garde artists who in sort of mainstream narratives are always identified as iconoclasts, right? Let's throw, you know, Tolstoy, you know, off the steamship of modernity, right? They are always positioned as being opposed to the past, right? As being very future oriented. And yet I think that wasn't in fact the case, right? That I don't think they were necessarily rejecting the past. I think they were kind of looking at ways of reinventing it. And I think that's not the same. And so these very hard divides between the 19th and the 20th century, the sort of post-revolutionary and pre-revolutionary moments, seem to me to be, you know, overstated in many ways in the existing literature. So I kind of wanted to go back and look at these relationships again, and just complicate that story a little bit.
Well, I could not agree with you more in terms of, you know, I think these periodizations definitely need reassessing, maybe need reassessing constantly, and especially in terms of the thing that you're describing about the local versus the global. You know, these things mean that the periodizations have to shift at the same time. So I'm thrilled to hear you say that. I mean, obviously I work on Russia too, so you're sort of preaching to the choir, but I hope our listeners also maybe think, oh, you know, this is an interesting idea and are influenced by it as well. So let's dig in. I mean, you've already sort of started describing some of the content that's in chapter 1 and 2, and maybe I should say the titles of these. The first chapter is called Byzantium Reconsidered, Revivalism, Avant-Gardism, and the New Art Criticism. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's contained in there. And then the second chapter is From Constantinople to Moscow and St. Petersburg, Museums, Exhibitions, and Private Collections. And I think that title gives a, you know, a big hint, as the first one does, about what's in that chapter. But talk to us about sort of what's contained in here, the discoveries you made, you know, what you're really proud of having uncovered or argued. There's a lot in them, so I don't even want to sort of venture a summary.
So I was sort of starting the book looking at the 18th century and predominantly the way in which Enlightenment views shaped the understanding of Byzantium in Russia. Of course, we're looking at you know, the reign of Catherine the Great, right? Who's a great Europhile, right, herself. So in that moment, right, we see Byzantium very much identified and understood in the way that it's understood in the rest of Europe, right, and France and Germany and England. And that's sort of, it's understood as the Dark Ages, right, a period that did not produce anything worthwhile artistically or culturally in general. So I start there, and I look at the way that we then see this gradual shift from the closing decades of the 18th century to the mid 19th century, where these views are revised. And of course, the revision of views on Byzantium are intimately tied in with Russia's own kind of self-conception as being peripheral, right? And this kind of century-long identity crisis that, you know, on the one hand, Russia is viewed as sort of backward, Asiatic, right? And in from that perspective, the Byzantine is seen as, you know, part of Russia's, again, kind of Eastern despotic legacy, right? And then on the other hand, there's this sort of understanding that maybe Russia's Westernization, as it was initiated by Peter the Great, Peter the First, right, was not unproblematic, right? Up until that point, it's seen as a positive. Russia's being Westernized, Russia's becoming more Europeanized. But with the rise of Slavophile thought in the mid-19th century, there's this way of really challenging those ideas and sort of thinking, and you can see how this makes sense coming, you know, in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars and then the Crimean War, where Russia is at, you know, in conflict with its European neighbors. And so this, you know, starts to put pressure on this idea of Russia as being part of Europe, right? Maybe Russia is, in fact, not part of Europe. And if it's not part of Europe, then what is it, right? And then what is its cultural legacy? It's not exactly part of Asia either. So in this case, Byzantium becomes this middle ground, right? And of course, historically, Russia adopted Christianity from Byzantium, right? So it follows the Greek, the Eastern Orthodox tradition. So it makes sense that both culturally and visually, Russia's sort of patrimony and heritage is coming from Byzantium. And so what we see and what the first chapter traces is this discursive shift in seeing Byzantium no longer as this sort of embarrassing, you know, dark stain in Russia's history, and seeing it more as a kind of an alternative to Western Europe and the Western European Latin and Gothic heritage. So that's sort of in very broad strokes where that chapter starts. And then it sort of looks more specifically at key figures such as Prince Grigory Gagarin, Nikodim Kondakov, and Adrian Prokhorov, who were sort of instrumental in spearheading both the kind of philosophical reevaluation of Byzantium for 19th century Russia, but also the very sort of real material excavation and restoration of these medieval monuments and icons, and sort of starting to reconceptualize these works not simply as these you know, medieval relics and cult objects, but actually as works of art with a capital A. And that's sort of what I then expand on in the second chapter, is sort of the way that these medieval works of art were institutionalized and exhibited to a broader public, right? How did some of these ideas go from a more narrow circle of academics and scholars to then sort of being part of a broader public dialogue and debate? And that's, you know, the fact that they were newly acquired in museums, right? And then we see a series of exhibitions where these works are then presented out to the public, again, no longer as these sort of cult objects, but as works of high art. And we start to see kind of a rise of an art historical literature around them, right? So there are new schools of icon painting that identified. And what does that imply? Well, it implies then that these works have their own stylistic schools, right? In the same way that we think about sort of Italian Renaissance art. They're no longer sort of viewed as timeless, you know, mindless copies, right, of the same artistic formula over and over again, but rather we start seeing an artistic evolution, right? And then once you have an artistic evolution, that implies that you can have originality, right? That implies that you can have master artists, right, who innovate certain things. So the second chapter very much looks at the way that there's this big shift in understanding these sort of Byzantine and Russo-Byzantine icons, not simply as archaeological curiosities, but as aesthetic masterpieces. So we have this kind of recasting. So those are the first two chapters, and that, I think, sets the scene, right, for the individual mm-hmm. artists.
Sure does.
So, yeah, I think
I wanted to say that, I mean, there's so many like individual points that you make in those first two chapters that maybe are too specialized for me to kind of dig into. But I thought that the tension that you describe in that first chapter between, and you mentioned this before, you know, the Oriental, as it's referred to, or the Asiatic, as you were just describing, on one hand, and the Byzantine, you know, is fascinating and has applicability well beyond what we Russian specialists, you know, think about. And I think really could stand to kind of revise understandings of what Orientalism as a whole are. So I wondered if you might say a little bit more about that, because it's such an important tension in that moment in the late 19th century and even earlier to understand.
Yeah, so this was something that I thought, of course, there's this whole idea of Byzantium being the medieval Eastern Empire to the Latinate sort of Gothic West. I think that's a distinction that has been both in the Russian and the European literature very much, you know, throughout the Enlightenment period. And it only really starts to be challenged in the mid-19th century. But there was this also very interesting thing that I sort of discovered while I was researching the first chapter. And that's that the Byzantine style, even within the Russian context, was sort of understood to be somehow more Eastern. And so, for example, when, in the sort of Russia's imperialist mission, right? When we see, you know, the Russian Empire expanding into Central Asia and the Caucasus, one of the things that would happen is that there would be a newly constructed Orthodox cathedral in sort of recently acquired territories, right, as a way of asserting a Christian Russian identity. And what's really interesting is that the further East you go, the more a kind of a particularly Byzantine style becomes used in the construction of these Byzantine cathedrals. So I thought there was this kind of equation, even by the Russian state, right, of Byzantium as being the kind of the historically validated style in these territories, right? So looking at places like Georgia, Armenia, but even going as far as, you know, Kazakhstan, there's a sense that, oh, well, if you're going to build a church, what style should you use? Well, of course, it should be Byzantine, right? But you can also see that there's a political imperative in that, right? Because at this point, Russia is very much in the late 19th century involved in the Eastern question, right? And where Russia claims to be the rightful sort of heir, right, both politically but also geographically, of Byzantium, right? So it's making all these claims to the Balkan territories, right, as opposed to, let's say, Austria-Hungary or the Ottoman Empire. Russia's sort of saying, well, Russia, not the Ottoman Empire, is the rightful heir to Byzantium, and therefore extending that logic, right, the sort of Greece and the Balkan states should be under Russia's territorial control. So there's also a kind of latent political agenda So it's not, you know, it's not purely aesthetic. It's not sort of innocent, but it does also kind of sort of really push on this idea of what is the Orient, and who is the rightful heir to Byzantium. And of course, that depends on how you see Byzantium, right? Is it Oriental, or is it something in between?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, still things that we're trying to answer today. So I hope that those who work on this really should read that chapter. If they don't read any other part of the book, that one, you know, has some sort of ways that you try to untangle these threads that I just think are so provocative, but really compelling also. So from there, after these first two chapters, you dig into individual artists, but you really treat them as kind of satellites, which is fascinating. I mean, you talk about in the introduction how you're going to think about them not in complete isolation, as sometimes happens in case studies, maybe when they're not done properly, but as part of networks. And the first of these, chapter 3, is on Mikhail Vrubel. And then chapter 4 is on probably the figure that's most well known to those, you know, who don't study Russia or even Russian modernism, and that's Kandinsky. And then the final chapter, Toward a New Icon, is on sort of Malevich, but then also Tatlin and what you call the cult of non-objectivity. So I want to take these one by one because these are major too. So talk to us about this Vrubel chapter. And, you know, I feel like you are becoming very much the world's leading expert on Vrubel. You've written a lot about him. So I'm most excited maybe for you to talk about this one.
I think one of the things that I was thinking through with the case studies, or the last three chapters, are really sort of me trying to think through and tease out the kind of the preoccupying question of why is it that in Russian modern art you seem to have this very unusual coexistence between sort of transcendental and mystical thinking on the one hand, and then a very sort of emphatic historical materialism on the other, and how these seem to be diametrically opposed. So and that's why I'm looking at Kandinsky on the one hand, and then Malevich and Tatlin on the other, because they seem to be in these opposing camps. But it's sort of in my research, and then in the book in general, I'm sort of trying to put pressure on that narrative, right, and those distinctions, and sort of say, well, maybe they are not as diametrically opposed as we think of them. And for me, there's, in fact, you know, when we look at Russian modern art, or even Russian literature, right, if we look at, you know, someone like Dostoevsky, there is this ongoing kind of dialectic, right, between the material and the mystical. So it seems that that is something that is very prevalent in Russian both artistic and literary culture, and I sort of wanted to see where is this coming from. And so for me, someone like Vrubel, who is a 19th century artist, very much embodies both of those trends in his art, right? On the one hand, we understand him to be a symbolist artist, and he was very interested in all kinds of biblical and apocryphal subject matter. He's best known for his series of paintings of the demon, right? And also he has a series of paintings of prophets and saints, right? And yet, on the other hand, he's really the first artist in Russia to challenge this kind of photographic realism, right? That is prevalent certainly in the 1870s and 1880s in the art of the Vidovizhniki or the Wanderers. And so he is sort of, you know, on maybe somewhat counterintuitively, is also asserting a kind of very materialist surface quality of his art, right? So this again felt like a kind of tension that someone is painting seemingly, you know, mystical subject matter, but then at the same time kind of asserting the pictorial surface of the canvas, right? And so, for example, a 20th century theorist who's Nikolai Tarabukin, who writes a monograph on Vrubel's art in the 1920s, sort of says, well, he's basically doing what Cezanne is doing in asserting using the kind of the grid-like pictorial structure of the canvas, right? And I'm emphasizing brushstroke. So he's doing that, but, and this is sort of Thurman Boukine's quote, he says, but Cézanne's still life view of the world was just completely contrary to Vrubel's kind of, you know, a transcendental kind of mystical aesthetic, right? And some of the themes that he explores. So to me, Vrubel was a kind of a natural starting point for looking at how these two trends in Russian art coexist. And of course, I also think he is one of these artists who then in the 20th century is very much recast as the kind of predecessor and the father figure of the Russian avant-garde. And of course, this is, you know, intimately tied in with a kind of nationalist project, right? We can see how, you know, theorists like Nikolai Punin, for example, who are proponents of a particularly Russian and subsequently a Soviet avant-garde, don't want to sort of root that movement in French modernism, right? They want to situate it in a particularly sort of Russian artistic history. And, you know, the logical sort of first kind of founding figure, right, is Vrubel. So there's a kind of interesting way in which he's also usurped by subsequent sort of art criticism and art historical writing, and then repositioned as this first modernist figure. And the icon is the kind of corollary to that, right? Because Russia doesn't have a Renaissance tradition, right? It sort of reclaims this iconic, you know, medieval tradition of art making as its kind of alternative genealogy for modernism. And so it sort of goes from the icons, you sort of jump to Vrubel, right? And then you go off to Kandinsky and Malevich. And of course, because Vrubel is painting, you know, these iconic themes as well, and he works on several restoration projects, he does sort of present as a link, right, between the medieval and then the 20th century. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that that is what, in fact, he was consciously doing, but that's certainly how he was reinterpreted by the 20th century critical and art historical establishment. Mm-hmm.
There's a line in this chapter that I think summarizes so well what you're describing, and I love it. It was one of my favorite lines in the whole book. You say, Vrubel employed medieval means to modernist ends. And I was like, yes, boom, that's it. It summarizes so much that when you really look at the paintings, you realize that is missing from Cézanne, or that is a departure. You know, this comparison is so strong. It's utilized so often, but it's really more complicated than that. And this business of medieval means to modernist ends, I think that is such a great takeaway. So thank you for writing it.
I'm glad you like that phrase. I think for me, it was sort of trying to think through, I think for Vrubel also, who was very much misunderstood during his lifetime. He was, you know, rejected by the official art establishment, by the official critical establishment. And so for him, because he was very much going against the grain of the predominant realist school, for him, kind of looking back to medieval fresco painting or medieval mosaics almost seemed like a kind of justification for what he was doing himself, right? So when he was using bright colors, right, or flat forms, and everyone was sort of criticizing him for this, he could say, there's a precedent for this.
It's very smart.
You know, I'm kind of continuing what the medieval, you know, someone like Andrei Rublev was doing, right? What the medieval masters are doing. So I'm not this kind of Western importation, right? Because there is a lot of nationalist rhetoric in this time period, especially when we think about it in their, like, you know, early 19 teens in the context of the First World War, right? So the sense that, you know, he's not simply kind of redoing Cézanne, right? He's doing something different, and something that has a kind of a national sort of, you know, something that could be viewed or understood as having, you know, roots in this national medieval past.
It's such great work. All right, now Kandinsky. I wonder if this was the chapter that you were the most daunted to write. I mean, maybe that's an unfair question, but I can say that having read it, I think it's the one that I'm most likely to assign in classes, both on Russian art and just, I think, on modernism. I mean, it really changed my understanding of someone that I think I know so well. So tell us what's in this chapter. Tell listeners what's in this chapter, and you know, whether you were daunted to take on such a canonical artist or whether it was like, no big deal.
Yeah, I think, you know, of course it's daunting because, you know, there have been so many books and exhibitions, right? Like, what can you possibly say that's new about Kandinsky? But one of the things that always struck me whenever, you know, I studied Kandinsky in art history classes or read about his work in textbooks of modern art was that everyone sort of says, well, you know, he's obviously, you know, I'm always a little hesitant to say the first artist to, you know, paint an abstract painting. But, you know, he's one of the pioneers of abstract painting. And everybody always discusses him in this kind of sense of like, oh, you know, he's a little bit weird. He's a little bit of an outlier. He does all this weird, like, spiritual, touchy-feely kind of, you know, like, what? He doesn't fit into the kind of, again, the Matisse, Picasso to Malevich kind of narrative because of this, you know, his insistence, right, on the spiritual and art, right? That's the title of his sort of seminal publication. And I sort of was interested in that and sort of thinking, well, you know, why does he, you know, really draw out the kind of the religious, the spiritual aspect of his work? That was sort of one part of it. I'm like, you know, why does he do this? He does seem like an outlier. I'd like to know why. But the other side of it was that, you know, he's kind of an interesting figure in that he's both in the Russian art world, but also very conversant with the European avant-garde, right? Because he's based in Munich for a long time. Then in the 30s, he immigrates to Paris, right? So I'm very interested of thinking about him. He's both sort of a Russian artist, but also kind of not at the same time. And at the end of his life, he you know, took on French nationality. So does he even count as a Russian artist? Ooh, so indeed. I was sort of interested in examining these two different aspects of his both his artistic identity and his work. And then what I realized is that, you know, when you consider his oeuvre in the context of this sort of Russian religious renaissance, this renewed interest in medieval and icon painting, and also, you know, not just in the art world, but also more broadly, right? We see the rise of this kind of humanist Christian philosophy by the likes of Sergei Bulgakov and Pavel Florensky, who are trying to reconcile, you know, religion with kind of a new reality of modern life. And so when I started to think about Kandinsky in that context, he doesn't seem like an outlier at all. Mm-hmm. No, on the contrary, it seems very natural. Like what he's doing makes perfect sense when you look at it in that context. So that for me was just sort of trying to, for myself, try to understand, you know, how is it that he turned into an outlier when in fact, when you think about him in this broader context, he's on the, you know, he's not an outlier at all. He's on the contrary, sort of an exemplar of this broader desire to reconcile a sort of religion and spirituality with modern science and a kind of modern epistemology without, you know, and I think a lot of, especially, you know, people like Pavel Florensky, who's one of the main representatives of this sort of religious renaissance in the early 20th century, he is himself an ordained priest, right? So these are people who are, you know, genuine believers themselves, and they really do want to reconcile, you know, these again, seemingly opposing poles of sort of faith and belief, and then sort of empiricism and science on the other hand. And of course, Florensky was an ordained priest, but also a scientist, right? So he's almost like the perfect person to be thinking through some of these issues and these questions. And so, and when I was reading some of his works, I saw a lot of parallels with Kandinsky's writing. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, if you actually consider that they were colleagues, right, at the Russian Academy of Sciences and at the Institute of Artistic Culture, they probably had offices, you know, on the same oh, floor, right, wild. Down the hall from each other. So I was sort of thinking, you know, maybe they discussed it together, right? And so it's possible that in fact Kandinsky just hasn't ever been really considered in this alternative context. Mm-hmm.
Well, like I said, I was really blown away. I think this chapter had some of my favorite comparison images too. I mean, you're really good with this through the whole book. I think it's a fascinating sort of, you could just look through the pictures in some ways in the book and get a sense of the shape or the scope of how many different directions your argument goes or what it contains as a whole. Obviously, if you read the book, listeners, don't get me wrong, if you read the book, you get a lot more out of it. I feel like the students are going to be like, oh, she said you could just look at the pictures. No. But you are a master of creating sort of comparisons, and nowhere was this better than in this Kandinsky chapter where, you know, showing the medieval icons compared to his really abstract works. I mean, not the weak abstraction, like the strongest versions of it. I was just like, oh my gosh, I need to think about this whole thing in a new way. So this leads us to the final chapter, which I also imagine you had to have been daunted to write. Malevich is also one of the, you know, the biggest, most well-known names, and you put forward some really fascinating stuff in this chapter as well. So talk to us about this one.
Yeah, so that one was me sort of thinking through this idea of a new realism, right? At the 010 Last Futurist exhibition, where both Totlin and Malevich presented their most canonical works for the first time. So Malevich's suprematist paintings and his Black Square, and then Totlin's Counter Corner Reliefs, right? This idea of these being the beginnings, right, the seeds of these, you know, major movements that would then go on to dominate the Russian art world in the 1920s. So suprematism on the one hand, and then constructivism on the other, although Totlin himself claimed that he was never a constructivist. That's a separate thing, but he was certainly understood that way by other artists of the time period, and then by subsequent art historians. So I was very interested how both artists use the term new realism, right? Which, of course, seems counterintuitive because these works are obviously not realist in the sort of 19th century sense of the word realism, right? And they're also quite different from each other. I mean, Malevich does these abstract geometric shapes, right, in pared down colors. The black square, of course, is a black square on a white background, but still working in a two-dimensional medium. And then Totlin puts together these, you know, he never called them sculptures, he called them artworks, but these, you know, three-dimensional structures, right, most of which are assembled through found materials, so wood, aluminium, sometimes rope. So it seemed like, you know, why realism, right? And one of the things that I sort of realizes that the way that they use the term realism was the way that icon painting was described by theorists like Florensky as being fundamentally realist, in that it was not a representation, right, of some alternative reality, but on the contrary, a presentation of it. And by that, I mean that in a kind of theological sort of conception of an icon, right, it is basically a material extension of the divine. Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which it has a completely different ontology to what we call, you know, like a normal, you know, artwork in the way that we understand it. And what's interesting in Russian too is that there's even a distinction on the level of language, in that one is called iconopis, right, which literally means icon painting, right, or icon writing, because pisat in the Russian means to write, and sort of painting in the way that we understand it is called живopis, which literally means writing from life, right? So there's this already, this distinction that one depicts a kind of observable reality, right? Painting from life. And the other presents a sort of unseen metaphysical reality, right? But according to theologians like Pavel Florensky, the reality of the icon, that reality is the kind of the truer, right, reality, right? Because it depicts a kind of, a metaphysical essence that is unseen with the human eye. And one of the things that's really interesting in someone like Florensky is that he then justifies it using ideas from sort of early 20th century science, saying things like, well, sort of retinal art is been fundamentally undermined by the discovery of the atom, right? Because there's this assumption that reality is what we see with the eye, and yet what modern science has shown that a lot of reality we don't see with the kind of naked eye, right? So there's this kind of interesting move to support these claims for, a metaphysical reality that exists beyond sort of what we see with our eyes. And so that kind of recasts the very idea of what realism is, right? It's not the kind of representational realism of the period Virginiki or the wanderers of the realist artists, but it's a kind of a deeper realism. And for Tatlin and Malevich, they use that in a materialist sense, right? Malevich claims that his realism is paint on canvas, right? What you see is what you get. And Tatlin claims that his realism is the realism of actual objects in real space, right? And not this kind of virtual Albertian window, right, of a kind of false reality. So I was kind of very curious to see why they use these terms, right? And why both artists invoke the icon. Malevich described the black square as an icon of his time. And of course, he displayed it in just above the ceiling, right, in a corner, which is typically how icons are placed, right, in homes. So I was very interested as to why that both artists would invoke the icon and what sort of dialectical and discursive purpose the icon served for them in recasting their art. And one thing that I think I came to realize as well while I was working on that chapter, that it also had a lot to do with the kind of politics of originality, right? Oh, and that's well that said, by yeah. claiming politics of originality. By claiming right that their art came from the icon, they could claim some kind of local genealogy, right? Rather than being just dismissed as being derivative of Picasso, right? So the Corn Counter reliefs are just, you know, Tatlin's take on Picasso's sculpture of his guitar, right? So this was a kind of way of claiming some kind of originality, right, in a broader pan-European context. So there's this kind of dual move. On the one hand, I think the icon genuinely had some resonance for them, right? But on the other hand, it's also just a kind of, I'd say, political move to say, we're not looking at Picasso, we're not copying Picasso, we're actually reinventing the icon. So I think that's sort of, you know, and of course, both are very different to what Kandinsky is doing. So to me, it was sort of interesting to see how all these different artists are getting different things from the icon and from this particular artistic heritage in coming up with a new, you know, modernist style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they definitely did get different things. I mean, you demonstrate that very clearly. I will point out, too, that this last chapter had my favorite sort of section heading title. And you have some good ones throughout the book. I'll let listeners, you know, when they read it, encounter them and sort of be surprised. But I think I sort of chuckled, but also was just, I don't know, I loved the what's in a corner, the historical conflict between Malevich and Tatlin. I mean, that was just like, oh, I have to use that in class now. What's in a corner? That's great.
According to you know, eyewitness accounts, we always have to take those with a sort of pinch of salt, but apparently that the when they were installing the show, the 010 show, that there was some huge fight that broke out between Malevich and Tatlin that actually sort of degenerated into an actual fist fight.
Nice.
And apparently what happened was it was because Tatlin claimed that Malevich stole his idea to display the black square in a corner.
And, you stole my corner? I mean, again, that's what they were yelling about? Like, you stole my corner?
They were really upset. And you can actually see, I have to say, I empathize with Tatlin because when you look at the corner counter reliefs, right, structurally they have to be displayed in a yes. corner, because that's how, right? So you can see how he probably did come up with that idea first. Uh-huh. And then Malevich was probably like, oh wow, that's really cool. Sort of on the 11th hour suddenly decided to hang his black square in that way, when, you know, logically, you know, it's a painting, so that's not how we normally display paintings. Yeah. Right. So there's this whole, you know, base, like an actual fist fight over this kind of the originality of displaying an artwork in a corner. Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, what like I just said, what is typically displayed in that way? Well, icons. Mm-hmm. Right. So that was, yeah, that was kind of it's actually really fun when you read a lot of these memoirs and letters from the early teens, right? And get a sense of a lot of these artists had really kind of larger than life personalities, they sure and did. They were really interesting.
Yeah, I can second that for sure. These primary source documents and witness accounts are great. Well, I know that we've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to make sure that I ask you one more question before you go, because we already sort of touched on it at the very beginning, but what are you working on now?
Oh, well, I already forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me. So now I'm actually interested in looking at sort of Russia's artistic relationship with Asia and the East. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, that very much comes out of my being in Singapore. So, you know, my perspective has been decentered, so to speak. And one of the things that I think is very prevalent in Russian art history is this constant discussion of the relationship between Russian art and Russian artists and the West, with, of course, Paris being as the artistic mecca as it was for, you know, most artists in the 19th and early 20th century. And so a lot of what is written is about, you know, how Western European and specifically French art influenced Russian art, how artists, you know, went abroad to Western Europe. And that's fine. You know, that's obviously a really important part of the Russian art story. But for me, I became increasingly interested in, well, what about the other side, right? Especially when we think about the Russian Empire being, you know, predominantly east of Moscow. What happens to, you know, artists, certainly Russian artists who traveled to some of Russia's, you know, colonial outposts. And a lot of artists did. A lot of artists traveled to Crimea and the Caucasus, right? And what about their exposure to these different cultures, right? Different religions, but also different representational traditions. And how did that impact their own art, right? and not just kind of constantly looking to the West, right? So my new project is going to look start in the late 18th century, right? To look at Catherine the Great's court, right, and the first Russo-Turkish War. And how that, impacted both the Russian visual culture, also material culture. There were a lot of, porcelain, sets made representing the Ottoman Empire, right? And then sort of going all the way up to, again, the early Soviet period and thinking about how in the wake of the creation of the USSR, what kind of visual apparatus were kind of deployed to address these new Soviet subjects who came from Central Asia, right? And one of the things that is sort of quite fascinating to see is that sort of ideologically, the rhetoric was very much that, we're counter-imperialist, right? We're anti-imperialist, we're anti-colonialist. And yet, visually, some of the sort of Soviet posters very much drew on these conventions of 19th century Orientalism. So I'm very interested in tracing that whole period and kind of rethinking, also thinking about collecting practices, right? You had a lot of imperial administrators coming back from these regions, bringing back a lot of local art, and sort of thinking about how this constituted another kind of alternative visual tradition and genealogy and how that inspired artists in the 19th and early 20th century.
Wow. Oh, that sounds like such a great project. I'll have to have you back on the show to interview you once that one's out as well.
Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. I really enjoyed talking to you about your book today. As I said before, I think it's a wonderful contribution to art history and to the study of Russian modernism. My name is Allison Lee, and this is New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I've been talking to Maria Tarutina about her new book, The Icon and the Square, Russian Modernism and the Russo-Byzantine Revival. Thanks for listening.